Good morning. I'm Donna Quinn, and for the next half hour, you'll be listening to Talk of Our Towns. I'm not sure how you would describe what an industrial psychologist is or what that person would do, but today we're going to find out. I'm pleased to have as my guest Dr. Nancy, also known as Red, Carritt. She's the author of two books, From Cop to Coach, The Revolution of Human Resources and People Management, and A Mental Health Moment for Human Resource Professionals. Although Astoria, Oregon is an anchor in her life, she travels extensively as a motivational speaker as well, working with such organizations as the American Red Cross, the University of Phoenix, and even Red Bull Energy Drink. She's here today on the north coast of Oregon to talk with us about her fascinating career, trends in the workplace, and other positive issues which will be relevant to all of us. Welcome, Dr. Carritt. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you, Donna. I'm so happy to be here.
Astoria is quite a marvelous place.
And today it's beautiful as all days. Rain or sun, it doesn't matter. It's always beautiful.
Every day is a beautiful day on the North Coast, even in the middle of storms. It's true. Exactly right. Good attitude there. That's what we have to say. There's no such thing as weather here. Before we talk about all of the various things you do, please let's talk a little bit about you, your background. A little biographical sketch would be lovely.
Well, I was raised in Southern California, and finally finished a bachelor's degree at a later age in life after raising my family, and then went on to get a master's and a doctorate. And after 15 or 20 years in the corporate arena as a vice president of human resources, I moved on and decided to start my own consulting company, which I did 11 years ago.
What is an industrial psychologist? If someone said, what does that mean? What do you say to that? Because that, yeah.
Industrial psychologists are those who work in the business arena. It's rather an antiquated term. They've tried to use organizational psychologists to replace the term, but then people think I organize stuff, which I don't necessarily do, at least not well in my office. And so industrial psychologists are a small percentage of the psychological community, and we work with business executives and organizations with their cultural issues, their employee issues, morale. And I do a lot of executive coaching one-on-one.
You work with people's minds, not with people's stuff, not with things.
That's right.
You're not organizing their desks. You're helping
That's
them
right.
organize what's going on inside, you know, internally.
That's right.
And you've also expanded in your business, and you coach, and you do motivational speaking, and you coach individuals as well. So you've decided to branch out from just the corporate or the nonprofit organizations or the workplace. You're actually working with individuals as well.
Right. Working with executives who want to get to the next level, who might not be where they want to be and they need a few new skills. Sometimes they're stuck and they just need a little bit of help. And so I sit with them and work with them about those issues that they want to fine-tune. Perhaps their leadership skills are not what they'd like them to be, or they're not making the impact they'd like to make on their organizations. And sometimes, in fact, more frequently in the last few years, CEOs choose to have an executive coach be one of the perks for their executive team. And they bring someone like myself in, and we actually coach on a regular basis every executive on their team. That would be an ongoing basis, not necessarily just when there's trouble or problems. This is to provide them, you know, an opportunity to brainstorm, vent, think through how they're impacting their organization, rethinking their leadership abilities, and, you know, facing their issues and talking through those with them.
So although a company could hear about you, a small business or a large corporation even, and you said a lot of people know about you by word of mouth and by your website too, they could say, we're stuck, we're having a problem, and we need you to come in and help us. They could also say, as you just mentioned, we want to be proactive. We want to help our producers. We want to help our people do even a better job than they already are.
That's right. And it started in the 90s where a CEO would say, well, to keep my team in top form, I'm going to offer them a coach as a perk, somebody that they can meet with on a biweekly or monthly basis to give them the support that they would like to have in this very pressurized job.
Dr. Carritt, I have noticed that coaching has just exploded, really. It's just on the scene. It's in people's... Why is that? In the last few years, even, and in every possible conceivable arena.
You know, I think part of it is that the employer, him or herself, can't provide all the kinds of support that a manager needs. And being the outside consultant, the outside psychologist, gives me a place of neutrality where I'm not on somebody's side. This isn't a problem person that I'm going in to fix. This is just a support system for very pressurized business times. I think the last 15 years have put huge stressors on executives and leaders to do more with less, to compete. I mean, the global picture is so broad now for most executives that they are really finding that the demands are very tough. And whether we're dealing with how they lead their organization or how they keep life balance in their entire life, personal and professional, I think there's just a big need for someone that can do that from the outside looking in.
I'd like to ask you what you think about this. There's a saying, it's not personal, it's just business. And then there are other folks, including a professor here locally, a business professor, who says, you know, that's not true. It's never just business. It's always personal.
That's right. We can't ask people to leave their real selves at the door when they come in. Now, in years past, we wish they could. It might be simpler to manage people if they were all about business. But people are a package of emotions and feelings and interacting with others and how they build relationships. All the skills that they bring to the table are things they learn someplace else. So I agree with the local professor that this is not just about business. And so you're dealing with a whole person, and that's what makes things complicated.
Since you became an industrial psychologist, things have really changed. Ever more technology, everything is speeding up, it seems. How have you had to adjust and tweak what you do depending on kind of what's going on socially and nationally and internationally?
Well, on a couple of different levels. One, technology-wise, I probably do as much phone coaching as I do in person just because everyone's traveling. I also think that because of the extensive pressures that we mentioned a minute ago, I do a lot of work around life balance with an executive who's just, you know, plugging away at a job that takes them 70 hours a week, but they also have a family and perhaps a spouse or a relationship to maintain, and that can be really challenging. So I think those pressures are different in kind of a new way in the last few years than, say, 15 years ago. Usually most executives, I don't have to ask them, are you going to be on the road? Should we schedule this to be a phone coach? They just are. That's just the way it is now.
What's the most rewarding part about what you do? What are some things you really enjoy about doing what you're doing?
Helping someone have the insight to get to the next level, whatever that is. That might not mean that I'm a CFO and I think I want to be a CEO and we're going to work toward that. Maybe it means I'm a CFO that needs a little better balance in my life, not just my personal relationships, but also the things I do for fun, the hobbies and the ways that I spend my free time. When I talk to executive groups, it's sad, but sometimes they'll say, when I ask, what are your hobbies? What do you do? No one can tell me what their hobbies are because they don't have time. And with a baby boomer workforce, most of them are, you know, the age that executives are mostly baby boomers. They are looking at retirement in a few years. And without hobbies or other activities, leisure activities, not only will they be hurting themselves now, but they'll be at a loss when they retire for things to do.
Certainly volunteering for worthwhile organizations is a great way for people who are retiring to use their time in positive ways.
Absolutely.
For themselves and other people, that's for sure. I guess I'm also curious about this idea of helping people through life transitions who are not in the corporate world, not businesses. I mean, I know you work with nonprofit organizations as well, but you also said you work with a lot of women who are in transition, and you put that age as midlife crisis between 40 and 60-ish kind of.
Right. And I don't know if we want to call it crises, but it is a change. It's a natural stage like the teenage years or childhood is. Dr. Carl Jung said it, and he identified it first, and now most psychologists agree that it is a stage where your overarching question is, how do I get more enjoyment from my next chapter of life? And with that very broad question, I'm working with executive women who are wanting to leave the workforce and start their own businesses, for example. I'm looking at midlife women who have not had a corporate career, but they want to do something now that's more satisfying than what they found themselves doing for the first 20 or 30 years of adulthood.
Then I would think that you really have to be a detective, because don't you have to figure out what are the person's values, their core values? And because a lot of times people aren't living from their core values. Would you say that's...
Absolutely. Yeah, and it really is a reason that people will find themselves very unhappy in a job that from the outside looks pretty satisfying. It may not even be that the job's bad. It may be that, one, it doesn't match their core strengths, as you mentioned, or it may be that they're at midlife and things have really changed. You know, you don't have the same preferences in those ways that you did at 25. You know, you're not building a career to support a family anymore. Maybe the family is gone and now you're dealing with empty nest or, you know, wanting to move on.
What are the tools that you use to help figure out where people are on the spectrum of change or what might need to happen for them?
Usually when I start to work with an executive, an individual, we work with a Myers-Briggs test first, which indicates your preferences, the style in which you interact with other people, extrovert, introvert, sensor, intuitor, and that'll give us your preferred mode of acting or being. And then we go on and do other tests. The Strength Finder is a great one that you can buy in a book off the shelf at one of the bookstores and find out your five top strengths. And it's, you know, a well-known fact that if you use your strengths, you'll find more happiness in whatever you do. So identifying the strengths can be really a catapult to getting you toward whatever that activity or job or business is that you want to run. And so the Myers-Briggs is one, and then we use one called a 360-degree feedback, but that's usually used for the executive who really wants to know how they're impacting their workforce. And we go and get a profile. We get feedback from all the coworkers to find out how that individual is affecting their workforce and how their relationships are working. And then we work on improving the things that don't look as good as we'd like them to.
Are there common themes that you see throughout your professional career here?
I think one theme tends to be that executives, if they haven't done any work on themselves, which most haven't, they don't have a realistic or clear picture of how they come across, what the reputation is that they're building by their actions and their words. And they feel stuck when actually, you know, some coaching and maybe a few tests will give them a much clearer picture of who they are. And we don't want to change them. We just want to capitalize on those wonderful strengths that each of us has. And then we move on to see how that can be crafted into making a great reputation and a great impact on your subordinates and your peers and your superiors.
So you're encouraging self-reflection. You're encouraging that the know thyself, right, and thou shalt know all. That you're encouraging people to look within. Many times I do feel that our societal messages are bottom line, meet your goal at any cost, whatever. And that's not working very well.
It's not. In fact, one of the other themes I thought when you asked me the question earlier was burnout. And it happens because someone wants to meet the expectations of the employer, and the employer's hammering for bottom line, you know, financial wins, when there's a whole lot more to work 8 hours a day that needs to satisfy basically the whole human being. We don't just go to work for money. And so, therefore, we need to work on all those pieces to make sure they're in a satisfying job or can create a satisfying job for themselves.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Talk of Our Towns on KMUN 91.9 and KTCB in Tillamook, Oregon. I'm your host, Donna Quinn, and my guest today is Dr. Nancy Kurit. She is an industrial psychologist, although she really does a lot more than that. She's a coach. She coaches individuals and organizations and businesses. She is here in Astoria. However, she travels all over the world doing this. And we're talking a little bit about trends in the workplace, and we're talking about things that she uses to help executives or human beings really move forward in their lives if they're in a stuck place or if they want to be proactive. You have people who know there's something, like you said, maybe things look good on the surface, but there's some little nagging, there's just not quite right. Do you think maybe people are disconnected from their, not only their authentic selves, but also maybe some creativity that's missing here?
Absolutely. I also think that we haven't perhaps given ourselves permission to change horses in the middle of the stream. So I chose this career and I'm going to stick with it, and I become more and more dissatisfied. And I think that the opportunity may arise if they look around to find something that's more satisfying. Now, maybe that means we keep the same job, but we do it differently. Or it could mean we keep the same job, but we start having leisure activities or hobbies, you know, learning to play a musical instrument, learning a new language, starting to garden, whatever that hobby might be that you haven't spent much time doing. so that they basically, instead of doing what they should do and must do, they choose to do something they can do or would love to do.
I have heard that if a person continues to be entrenched in old behaviors, that leads to rigidity, and rigor mortis is death, obviously. So the more rigid we become, the worse it is for us, and on all levels. I mean, our bodies, how we move them, and everything. So it would seem to me that you are encouraging people to be more flexible and to be willing to change. Do you feel like most people make changes because of crisis, or are there other ways somebody can say, I need to make a change, I'm not in crisis, I feel like I need to make a change, though? How does change happen?
I think that deep change happens from some kind of psychological need. Hopefully, it's not always about crises, but I do believe that that's one way that people get onto a whole nother track. You know, we have a tragedy in our lives, and we reevaluate what the meaning of our lives is and what we want to do in the years we have left. But I think that people can decide to change because they get to midlife. As I said before, the overarching question is, how can I find more satisfaction in my middle years? And so with that burning question, they go out and search. And, you know, you can open newspapers and books today and find many, many stories about particularly women. I think it's 2 to 1 who are going out and starting a new business or creating their own kind of retail or craft business or cottage industry business because it's something that would be more satisfying to them. So I think you can have more than the crises, but I think that it has to be some kind of burning need. You know, behavior doesn't change easily. As a psychologist, I can tell you, you know, usually it's for changes only happen because either you have the threat of pain or, to your point, crises, or you have the promise of some kind of reward. And so those two things typically catapult somebody into change.
If you were going to advise people listening to this program about one perhaps simple thing they could do in their lives from the years that you've spent working with as an executive coach and a motivational speaker, what would you say to people? I know that we've talked about a page on your website which talks about the bucket list. What would you say to people?
A bucket list is a great way to start. A bucket list would allow someone to sit down and dream their dreams and list all those things they wish they had done or could do or they could be or they could have or they could experience. Those are the four categories. And with that, you can make a list that includes all the places you'd like to have traveled or the hobbies you haven't spent time learning or, the places you'd like to go. But I think also one of the things you can do immediately is look at your schedule. I always end up going back to, how are you spending your time? Where are your priorities, and how much of your time are you spending doing something you don't love, doing something you feel you must do, and the rest of the hours might be dropping off and you might not be using the time the way that you could. And so looking at your schedule, how full is your plate? How many hours are you spending at work? How many hours are you spending doing an activity you love? It can be alarming to find that you're spending 60 hours at work and no hours at something you love.
Do you find that most people are successful in making the kinds of changes that you recommend to them when you work with them? Because I know that one of the reasons that coaching is popular is because there's accountability. Many people can read a lot of books and say, oh, yes, I know if I do this, then this will happen. However, I think that accountability is a crucial piece.
And the accountability really is kind of twofold. One, they're going to come back to me and we're going to sit and talk. And two, if they're in an organization, the organization is looking for improvement or behavioral changes. That's a good way. But, you know, positive change happens also because the person themselves feels happy or satisfied or more rewarded with the change that they've made. If I decide that I'm going to spend 3 hours a week now learning a musical instrument, I wanted to always learn to play piano and now I'm going to do it, then 3 hours a week is going to give me enough pleasure that when I sit down and reevaluate or when I sit with my coach, I'm happy about how I'm spending a little bit of the time I have in the evenings when I get home from work.
What do you think keeps people stuck? Is it fear? Fear of the unknown? What? Why do people they know that they should stop smoking, get a different job, use their skills in a different way, and yet they know it, but they're not able to quite do it. Is it fear?
Yeah, fear has a lot to do with it. Fear of change and fear of failure are the two that probably come up most often. If I'm halfway happy in a job, or if I'm making ends meet and able to pay my bills in a job, why would I want to go out and look for something that might not even pay as much but might be feel more satisfying? That's a value decision that we make. And as I mentioned before, very often midlife years, 40 to 60, they're willing actually to drop the monetary is not as important as it once was, and they're willing to go for something that's more pleasurable or more satisfying. But yes, there is a, you know, I must do this, I should do this, I have bills to pay, so I'm going to stay in this job even though, you know, I'm very unhappy with it. And that's a very common way for folks to look at. They choose a path and they stick with it come what may. And that's too bad because, to your point, there's a lot more out there, but the fear can keep them stuck.
When you work with people on an individual basis, do you have a timeline? Do you say, okay, here's where we think we're going to identify where we think you are and where we think you want to be? And I, based on my years of experience doing this, I feel like if you are committed to doing this, whether you're an executive or even a because you're working with individuals. I mean, companies, yes, you're working with a company, but a company is people. It's a group of individuals making up this company. Do you then have a timeline and you say, okay, here's a goal we want to get from A to K, and here's how I think we're going to do this, and here's what I'm going to help guide you. Here are the commitments. Here are the landmarks that we have to reach. Is that how that works?
We usually set milestones along the way, but if they're inside an organization, that's a very broad table of influences and issues and change that might alter our pathway within weeks or even days. So I wouldn't guarantee that we were going to get someplace in a certain period of time, but the coaching process where we're going back and forth and they're looking around at the organization as they make the changes probably allows us to tweak that deadline or tweak that goal. So if we say in 6 months we want a new job or we want a promotion, that may not happen, but we're going to take all the steps possible to get us as close to it as possible. And then, you know, we're also going to practice, to your point, flexibility so that if it doesn't happen that way, we still have some new skills, we have a new outlook, we know that we have a broader reach and we can do other things if we need to get us there.
And really just taking a baby step, just moving in a positive direction, that is very empowering for people, I think. And what do you do about the negative self-talk, though, that most people have? I just read something the other day which said that by someone I thought was really, I admired and said, this is a very successful, this person has it together. And he wrote, everyone thinks that other people have it together. No one has it together. Everyone feels like they are a fraud. Is that true?
No,
do you think?
No, I don't. I think he probably thinks at some level or has struggled with that issue himself, and that's why he perceives that everyone else does. And that's where I would go with that. But I think that the negative self-talk is a huge issue for many, many people. And it's sad to hear that it would be the driver for someone to getting ahead because they're basically beating themselves up with that self-talk along the way. And self-talk is that small little voice that's narrating to you how you're doing and what you're doing at all times. And if you're thinking right now, I don't have a little voice like that. I know I don't have a little voice. That's the little voice. And it's talking to you.
Okay. There's an Annie Lamott wrote a book and she said, I really do want to listen to my authentic inner wisdom. It's just that there's a radio station in my head and all of these channels are telling me conflicting things. How do I know which is the right one?
I've read that. I think that's great because it just means that she's considering more of the variety of influences that she can have instead of that one voice. If we're locked into one voice, it might be our mom's voice or, you know, a parent's voice who's beating us up or criticizing what we're doing. And the truth is we need to stop the negative talk every time we hear it. And actually I tell clients that once you're aware of the concept of self-talk, now you can actually very easily monitor it. You'll hear it when it comes and beats you up, when you're driving in the car and you're thinking, I can't believe I really messed up on that last interview. Oh my gosh, I'm so stupid. You can stop it right there and rephrase it and say, this one didn't go well. How am I going to do this one better next time? And actually rephrase the self-talk. And it's known to work. It's actually a cognitive behavioral skill, and the self-talk can be changed and it can be restated. And that's the good news because, to your point, everyone seems at some point to struggle with some of that negative self-talk.
work the solution, don't work the problem. Think of the solution, think of the next step you can do. And Americans really are resilient people, too. I think we constantly reinvent ourselves. A lot of other cultures, I think people are stuck, well, this is what my great-great-grandfather did, and this is what I am now fated to do, you know. And whereas here, really, people can constantly recreate themselves. And we just have a few more minutes left. What are some of the real joys that you have in this work? And I would think it would be because you would come into an organization which perhaps has been stagnant, and you can see a way to release some energy which is stuck, and then you're able to see people make positive changes.
Well, two examples I can think of, but one with an organization who had just gotten a new CEO. The new CEO was a very different kind of individual than their previous leader, and they were all a little shell-shocked when he came in. And the first things that I heard when I was working with the executive team was how frustrated they were at some of his behaviors and some of his activities, and he wasn't as easy to find or reach or interact with because he was, frankly, out doing wonderful things for the organization. And this, I heard this for almost a year before we finally got the message across that this was because of a great plan to grow this company, and it has since grown in leaps and bounds in new directions and all kinds of exciting things that this CEO actually brought into the organization. But until we were able to work, and I worked individually with each of the executives and the couple of layers of executives and managers, they understand that this was a great thing and that they could support this idea and that it was good for all of them. And the organization has really, really taken off. And I think they're all willing to give credit to that very wonderful new CEO that leads the organization now.
Many times, perception's reality. Would you say that that's a truism?
Yes, absolutely. In this case, there was a learning element, though. I mean, if you've had one kind of boss or leader, that's what you're prepared to follow. And when someone comes in with such a different path, it can be very confusing. You were in a comfortable position doing certain things, and now he may want different things from you or your team.
Dr. Corrett, I think we could talk for a couple of hours about all of these things, and I'd love to have you come back on at some point. And I think it's great that you are here on the North Coast, that you are available for nonprofit organizations and corporations and people who are having issues. Everyone has issues. Everyone has issues with growth and change, and that is the constant in life. So if you are interested in talking with Dr. Corrett, her website is drnancyc.com, and that's drnancyc.com. And I will leave information here at the station as well. On your website, I do think before this movie, The Bucket List, came out, you were telling people to do the bucket list of things they want to do.
That's
before
right.
The movie came out.
That's right.
so that might be a little pearl of wisdom for all of you who are listening today.
Start your list, pin it on your bathroom mirror, and be able to cross 5 things off a year that you've accomplished, that you've done.
All right.
It's been a pleasure, Donna. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for being here today. And I want to thank you, Terry Wilson, our engineer extraordinaire, as usual, and also Michael Brunn for his original banjo music for this program. Until next week, find a moment for yourself today. Take a deep breath with gratitude for all the good things in your life and focus on those good things. Expand them. And then give yourself a loving and compassionate hug or a pat on the back for being uniquely you, for doing the best you can, and for being here now in this moment on the amazing planet we call Earth.